They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your this quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two to one be mine?
Hey, welcome to the Baker Street Babes episode 2. It has been a journey to get here, but we're here. Joining us today, we have one of the other babes. Turk is here. Say hello, Turk.
Hello. That was my serious voice, in case you were wondering.
Very, very serious. And we have two guests here today. First, we have Maria from Germany.
Hi.
Hi.
And not more importantly, not that you're not important. Caitlin is here, a very famous, awesome songs of awesomeness.
Oh, shucks.
We're going to pour the flattery on.
So say hello, Caitlin.
Yay.
Hello.
So we're going to introduce these three lovely ladies to all of you, so all those that are watching. Artie is not here today because, like a good person, Artie is doing their dissertation. So yay for that. And for some reason, Marie's microphone is being a wanker, so...
Allowed to say that?
This is the internet. I'm allowed to say whatever I want.
Fair dues.
Turk.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into Sherlock Holmes? What is your favorite character? Who is your favorite character? What's your favorite story? And what is your favorite adaptation?
Okay, you're probably going to have to remind me after a bit, because I'll forget. I first got into it. The first thing I saw that was Sherlock Holmes, I was vaguely aware of it, but then I saw the 2002 film with James Darcy, A Case of Evil, and just completely fell in love with that. The way Sherlock and John are in that film, they're just so funny together. And then shortly after that, I saw The Mystery of the Manor House, which is another really obscure adaptation. And then I thought, okay, I actually really like this, I'm going to read the stories, because I'd been avoiding it for a while. And then I read most of them in a really short space of time at the library. And after that, I was just sort of kind of, not obsessed, but really amused. And then I saw the advert for the 2009 film, and I was like, oh, I don't think it doesn't really look the same as the other ones. It doesn't really look like the books. So I didn't go and see it. And then I saw the BBC were doing one. I thought, that man looks like Colin Morgan. I'm gonna watch it and see if he's like Colin Morgan, and he wasn't, but I enjoyed it anyway. So that was how I got into it, with A Case of Evil, and then slightly more with each new thing. But what was the next question after that?
Your favourite character.
My favourite character, Sebastian Morin. He's just so. I know he hardly appears.
Only you
just,
would say that.
I don't know. He's really sort of badass and mysterious, and the fact that, you know, Moriarty's dead, and he's like the best second in command you could ever have, because he's like, you killed my boss, so I'm going to shoot you in the face. I'm going to get you. It's just so. There's something quite. I like a bad guy anyway in a film usually. So the fact that, you know, there's this bad guy who's loyal and amazing and really good at creeping around in the dark. And so I guess it's not that difficult. Yes, my favourite story is The Empty House. I just love that there, obviously, Morin's in it and he's doing all sorts of badassery. And then on the other hand, you've got Holmes and Watson tricking him into stuff and then being in the same room in the dark, and it's just, oh, I don't know, I just find that the most exciting of the stories as well. Really sort of, I just remember the first time I read it, it really gripped me. I was like, oh my god, what's going to happen? Oh. So, yeah, that was my favourite. Well, there was another question, wasn't there?
Favourite adaptation.
It's still between the two I saw originally, the Case of Evil and Mystery of the Manor House, but I think I've got this weird sort of headcanon now that the version in the Mystery of the Manor House, that's he's 17 in that, and he's really sort of smarmy and annoying. He plays all sorts of tricks on his little cousin. He's just, I don't know, he just seems like how Sherlock would have been at that age. And then in the Case of Evil, he's about 23, and he's obviously going through his rebellious drinks and drugs and sex phase. And then... And I like to think that that one grew up into Benedict's Sherlock. So basically all three of those adaptations, because for me, in my head, in some weird way, they're all the same. It's like a progression of the same guy. And I like that they all sort of fit together like that.
Well then. All right, well, Caitlin, same questions for you.
I'll try to keep them in order and whatnot. The first sort of Sherlock Holmes thing that I ever came across was covered pretty well in your last podcast, because the first one thing that I ever saw regarding it was The Great Mouse Detective.
Yes!
Obviously, I love that. But there were these, I don't know if they were even like a national thing in America or if they ever got beyond the borders of this country, but there were these really terrible children's adaptations of the stories that looked like they were really thick books, but in actuality only had about 30 pages of text in them.
Yes, the illustrated classics!
Yeah, those. I would just, like, toddle into a Walden Books at age 4 and just sort of, like, go through these really, really pared-down versions of the stories.
I had the Little Women version of that.
Yeah, and it was, like, the illustrations weren't even that good. They looked like coloring books. I really enjoyed it still, and I would sort of just read that really pared-down version and look at the pictures and try to infer more story into it. But I didn't read the actual stories for a really long time. I'm in the middle of rereading them now, and it's very exciting.
That character?
Probably John Watson.
Yes. Join the John Watson fan club.
The thing is, it would totally be Sherlock, except I think it's in Sign of Four when John is talking to Sherlock, and he's talking about how he's going to go hang out with Mary Morstan. In those exact words.
That's how they rolled in the Victorian period.
Yeah. And Holmes says something about, oh, well, you know, don't talk to her too much. Women aren't to be trusted. And John basically says something along the lines of, like, barely was restraining myself from hitting him, I left. And I was like, well done, John. So, you know, it probably would be Sherlock if it weren't for the fact that Sherlock's kind of not great about women.
I think the term is misogynist.
Yeah, that's the term. There are big multiple syllable things for that.
Yes.
So John is just adorable and so self-deprecating. Like, when he first meets Mary Morstan and he's talking about how he needs to just accept that his life is going to be misery because what angel would come hang out? You know, it's... And he's just such a lovely man, but he doesn't realize it. And for some reason, that is endearing.
Yeah. <Yep. laughs> favorite story?
Like favorite adaptation or favorite one of the stories?
Favorite one of the stories.
Okay, let me think. I just finished reading The Red-Headed League.
Mm.
I really found that one. So that might have to be it, just because it's such a good story, but when you just sort of try to describe it to someone, it sounds so silly.
Yeah.
In The Sign of Four, they do describe Toby, which is the best thing ever. So, I don't know. Probably one of those two.
Just for the description of Toby.
Oh my gosh, have you read...
No, I haven't read The Sign of Four yet. I don't know.
Well, it's like, it is distracting how adorable the description of that dog is. Like, I was in the middle of this really, like, well-to-do family situation, and I was reading this book because I whatever. And I just stopped what some of my family members were doing and read out the description of Toby because I was just like, this is the best description of a dog in literature ever. I don't know. I've never said I was cool.
That's all right. None of us are.
And then your favorite adaptation?
Yeah, BBC.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could have guessed that.
Yeah. You know that TV show I've written like 7 songs about?
Look at that segue. Let's talk about your songs. So I guess basically, what made you start writing songs about the straining buttons on Benedict Cumberbatch's chest and various other things?
Well, the first one that I wrote was the Martin song.
Right.
And that was literally just because my friend Bridget had had a really bad day. And so I sort of just write dorky songs when I'm trying to write serious songs, like as a sort of segue into writing serious. I don't know how it works, but it tends to. So for pretty much every serious song I've written, there's a dorky one that preceded it. But I figured she would really like that one, so I just put it up, and people liked it a lot. I was really startled by that, but so I was just like, well, I kind of write nerd songs all the time. I guess I'll start recording them because people might enjoy that.
Yes.
And blow.
Like, the amount of, like, Twitter messages and emails we've gotten just because of your song.
Really?
Yes. Everyone's like, are you going to have another song? Is there going to be a song? I'm like, well, she's coming on the next podcast, so I think we probably will.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
With your blessing.
No, definitely.
Have you written a song about Toby? You should write a song about Toby.
Oh, I really want... The thing is... Okay, so the next song that I'm going to do on my YouTube thing is a song about Molly Hooper.
Yay!
And,
Yay!
But on her blog, she talks about how her cat's named Toby.
Oh, so really?
Have you not read the blogs?
I've only read Sherlock's and John's. I didn't read
Oh, no. You have to read the other one as well, because she goes on, like, she talks to Jim on it, and there's this whole big thing where they, like, watch Glee together. have you not seen this? And then it comes as, like, a big shock when he's, like, obviously, but sorry if you haven't seen it, turns out to be Moriarty.
If you haven't seen it, why the hell are you listening to this?
I ask you this now, imploringly.
The great thing about when they reveal that they watch Glee together is that it's this built-up conversation where, like, I think Jim says, like, oh, thanks for last night. It's just, like, this sort of repartee that sort of sounds like they're talking about some old shady sexy times. And then it just turns out they watch Glee.
And Jim's like, I can't believe I haven't seen it before. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Her blog's a special kind of tragedy.
Oh, like, he's really insulting about her nose on there, and for no reason. Oh, yeah, you're the one with the nose. What's wrong with my nose? Nothing.
Wow.
That's kind of sweet in a creepy way.
He's kind of creepy, though. Well, like, even when he comes on, like, he kind of sidles on, and it's like, hi. You're like, that guy's kind of creepy.
Oh, so you're Sherlock Holmes. Molly, tell me all about you.
Yeah.
Are you on one of your cases?
That's pretty good.
All right, so the you need to write a song about Toby, basically.
Yeah, well, Toby is mentioned vaguely, not vaguely, by name. He's mentioned by name, but it's just really brief at the end of the Molly Hooper song. But I was actually debating with myself whether that counted as including Toby in a song or not. So I'll probably write a Toby song. Let's not kid ourselves.
What's your process when you go to write one of these songs?
Oh, it sort of varies. Sometimes I actually have the intention of sitting down and writing a specific song about a specific topic. Sometimes, like, I'll have a chord progression that I like, and then I'll just get a pretty good combination of words that I like and go off of that. Like, that's what happened with the Baker Street Babe song, because I had the phrase 2-2-1 be mine.
which I love.
I'm glad. I wasn't sure if that was going to be like, oh, that's sweet, or like, that is the dorkiest thing I've ever come across. And maybe it's a mix of both. And any song where you get to use the word quotidian is pretty fun. So.
Okay, that's the word that we kept missing in our version.
For your information, we attempted to sing it whilst under the influence of a lot of water, in case there are any children listening to this right now, which we shouldn't be. And we got all the words wrong.
Not all of them.
just most of them.
It's like, 2, 2, 1, 2, 9.
You know, it's a hard word to say regularly, let alone when you're dizzy off of water. You have an excuse.
Drinks a lot of water.
Drinks a lot. I just had some water.
Yeah, a nice glass of water. Moving swiftly on. For the schedule today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Sherlock fandom and how it's evolved over the years. Because obviously Sherlock Holmes being one of the oldest... I guess it is one of the oldest fandoms, really, because I remember having a conversation with one of my friends at work about it, and it's one of the first... kind of novels that spawned not only a very, very long canon, but also you've got all the pastiches and things as well. So it's been alive, you know, pretty much since it was first written. So let's have a discussion about that.
I mean, the most obvious example is when he killed off Sherlock.
Spoilers!
And there's just, like, the public outcry. It's like, you can't do that, dude. We kind of like them.
Well, because people went down to the Strand, didn't they, with, like, banners and, like, dressed in black and actually, like, proper full-on mourning. And I think that was the point in which Arthur Conan Doyle was like, why?
He wanted to get out of it. He wanted to write, like, other stuff.
Yeah, and I think he was really glad to kill him off.
Yeah, he's like, no, you have to continue writing Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, in his diary he wrote, actually, on the day that he finished the writing of the final problem, he wrote, killed Holmes, and that's all. That's the entire entry on his diary on the day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That almost sort of sounds like a Moffat tweet.
Instead of killed Rory.
Yeah.
I had to pull that in there.
It's fascinating as well because obviously in the last episode I talked about my epic love for Raffles, which again is like another one of the very first mystery stories that you get. But obviously there's no mystery in that because you know that who's stealing things. It's whether he'll get away with it or not that is the kind of mystery. Whereas with Sherlock Holmes, it's and also because of course at that particular time you've got the murders in Whitehall from the supposed Jack the Ripper, and that you know gripped the public fascination. So there's obviously an element to this kind of mystery, even if you know it's not murder, the mystery that draws people in and they want to like know more about it. And that's, you know, probably one of the reasons why it survived so long.
It's Whitechapel, not Whitehall.
Yeah,
it was in Whitehall. I was like, Whitechapel.
I know what I was talking about.
Like the power pin, like how they're trying to like draw more people. And I think even recently, because you kind of had this surge of like Sherlock Holmes stuff. And we'll talk about this later, but Moffat and Gatiss tonight at the Q&A talked about how there was nothing for quite a while Sherlock Holmes-ish. And then the 2009 movie with Guy Ritchie came out, and then BBC, like, all at once. So it's, like, drawing more people in that maybe at first didn't read Sherlock Holmes growing up or didn't really know that whole much about it. And then, so, like, using the media to, like, draw more people into, like, this Victorian age and, like, really love the books and love the stories. I was going somewhere with that.
You were going to make a point. Well, I think you can also say, like, before Sherlock Holmes, even though there was, like, a kind of a big gap, there wasn't really, because you've got loads of those CSI programs.
Yeah.
So it's never really gone away. Because people are really fascinated by that kind of thing. It is something that, like, I don't know, like, even like the trashiest, putting on the sunglasses and telling a cerebral pun.
Yeah!
People love that stuff. So Sherlock Holmes is kind of like almost like the original character.
CSI.
The original. Yeah. It's almost like hypocrisy or that, not blasphemy to say that he has to be CSI. But I was going to do some research actually about early crime fiction, which I haven't, because that would have made me sound more intelligent on this podcast. But there was definitely a lot of writers. Obviously, you've got Agatha Christie from somewhere in Europe. Can't remember
somewhere in Europe.
I'm going to look that up and actually like talk about it next episode, like, so that I sound really intelligent. But there was a early detectives and early authors who used to use methods, and there was one particular man, I think, who used to go through people's rubbish. This is like really early on in like the 1900s, and that was like the first kind of forensic science, and people thought he was crazy, but everybody used to throw away like really incriminating letters and things, and he'd just find them all. And now Everybody's like, oh, okay, that's actually quite a good way to like find out stuff.
Oh, no, definitely.
Huh. There you go, you've learned something new.
I have learned something new.
It's not a very precise fact, but in the depths of what I just said, there was a fact there.
Yeah, and then there's Chester with Bob Brown. Also, not quite a Sherlockian character, but still. I mean, he's a detective.
There you go.
Probably the original monk. That might be. Because there's a German series based on Father Brown, and it's been on for 20 years or something.
Oh, wow.
So, it's been around.
Oh. So, obviously, that thing lasts the test of time.
Something that I do like about Gatiss and Moffat, can bring it back to those two.
Bring it back.
About the fact that they're fans who are making more Sherlock is that they aren't just sort of satisfied to let people watch their Sherlock. They make enough references both within the show and like on their Twitter feeds and things that it just encourages people to go back and sort of see the progression of Sherlock in his different portrayals throughout the years. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, what was it the other day he posted the picture of the steps? Like all these like little details, like it's just very fantastic.
Well, also like in the thing we watched today, like they were saying, they were talking about how they really love the Basil Rathbone series, and like they're pretty much saying to us, like, you know, go and watch it. We watched The Secret Life of Sherlock Holmes as well, and that was fantastic. We'll talk about that later. But, oh my god, I cried. but yeah, no, they really like say like these are the ones we enjoyed. Why don't you all go and watch them, and then come back and watch ours, and then you know kind of enjoy in the whole experience of all the things that have come out of it.
Why has Sherlock Holmes' legacy lived on? Like, why has it continued to be like so? So loved.
I think just because the stories are genuinely that good. You always, I mean, there's been so many writers over the years, like hundreds of years ago, and how many of them are really famous now? And when you look at it, it's really how good, how enjoyable, how accessible the stories have been, really. And I think there's a Sherlock Holmes story for everybody, because they're all quite different. There's a way in for everyone. And then since they've started making adaptations, there's all these different new ways for people to be introduced to it. It's just... And no, I just think because it's so vast and there's so many different versions of it that I think nearly everyone can find something to love about it.
That was a very good answer.
Yeah, that was a good answer.
Because I was bad and I really wanted to use that segue... we didn't get to ask Maria about
Go on, Maria. The microphone is yours.
Okay. So I don't remember actually when I first had my first contact with Sherlock Holmes. The initial contact. But I remember that I always knew about Sherlock Holmes, and I remember going to Austria on holiday and actually going to Meiring and visiting the Reichenbach Falls and the museum and reading the letters to Sherlock Holmes, which was really cool. And I think that's also one of these things that people think he's an actual person. And, you know, even though Arthur Conan Doyle wrote in the study in Scarlet that Watson kind of compares him to Dupin, and then Sherlock Holmes complains and says, you know, Dupin is this really awful fellow, he's just trying to show off, and it's exactly the same thing that he does. And Watson says, you know, I would have never thought that there would be a character outside of a story like you. So it's obviously, you know, he's made Sherlock Holmes to be a person who's not in a story, or is, you know, more than just a character in a story. So I think that is what kind of, you know, fascinated me. And then I've always kind of had the Granada series around. I don't even remember which was the first thing that I saw. And then I saw the the funny version. Which one was that? The Michael Caine one? What was it? What was that called? I forget the title of that. But that was really hilarious. And it's just always been around. But in Germany, we don't really read Sherlock Holmes. We don't really, I don't know, it's not that famous. Yeah, so it's just always been there. And then I started studying British studies and, you know, went into English literature. And of course, did detective fiction. And then, you know, I was reading most of the stories, and I'm now teaching them. I just did, just on Thursday, I just did a comparison between the study of Scarlet and the study of Pink, so I'm totally bringing my fandom to my classroom.
Well done.
Yeah, I know. what's the next one? My favorite character?
I have a question for you.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Wrapping my phone, like, I've seen pictures of it, and it really doesn't look that terrifying.
It's
like,
not at all. It's not. You would not die falling down. You could not disappear. Like, literally cannot disappear. It's like a foot deep. It's tiny. So they must have, I don't know, ran off or something. I don't know.
You just know it's like you just
freeze there. Yeah, there's a little white star, and you just know that that's probably the point where he, you know, where they fell off, and it's just okay. You might break something, but I don't think you'd disappear for 3 years after that.
So, kind of is.
I don't know if he ever actually. No, he must have been there because Doyle went to Austria. He was a fan of Austria. He went there when he was younger and he went hunting and stuff and skiing.
Maybe
he introduced skiing to the Alps.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
It was probably. It just said rained a lot and then it just it just seemed really terrifying and he just saw it from above or something. I don't know. So yeah. It's not very convincing if you go there. So please keep on believing that the falls are really huge and terrifying and you can definitely die when you fall down. And I apologize to all the people in mining who think that I've now destroyed their reputation. Sorry.
Favorite character.
My favorite character, that's a hard one actually. I really, really do, of course, like John Watson. But I do like the arrogance in Sherlock Holmes. I really, really enjoy that. So it's kind of a draw. It's just, it's the couple. it's the character of both of them that I really enjoy. And I really like the observations of Watson of Sherlock's arrogance. He just keeps on talking and then he suddenly laughs. We have Lestrade and Gregson talking. And they seem really smart, and then Watson describes how Holmes starts laughing in their faces, and I just love that. I mean, that's just. And this is also why I really love A Study in Scarlet, because the whole introduction, and I think that is my favorite story. The whole introduction is really neatly done, I really love that. And I also love the BBC version of that, and I was reading A Study in Scarlet in preparation for my course, and I was just. I was sitting in Starbucks reading it and just laughing my ass off the entire time through all the pages. And then when I was, there was a family sitting across from me and I didn't notice because I was just immersed in the book. And then the girl, she must have been a teenager, I don't know, 14, 15, she just came over and asked me what I was reading because I was laughing the entire time. I was like, oh, it's just Sherlock Holmes. She's like, oh, cool, I've never heard of it. I'm like, what? That's Germany. That's what I mean. Sherlock Holmes is kind of, he's known, but nobody reads him. Because it's not canon, it's not, you know, it's not school canon, you don't read Sherlock Holmes stories. And it's not, we have other people, you know, other authors that you are read to when you're a child. We have Astrid Lindgren, for instance, and quite a few German authors. So even as a child, you don't really get into contact with Doyle. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of, I hope, and they're airing Sherlock in a month, I hope they do. And so I hope that will change things a bit. But the Granada series was... Well, I think BBC. I was floored. I mean, I was just watching it. And even before Sherlock showed up, just the Russell Square, because I'm such a fan of London. That's John Watson, Russell Square. I'm in love with this. I don't care what's happening. And then we have the writing prop scene. I was just, okay.
Yeah. I think that's
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was just really... I fell in love with it the first 10 minutes. And it was absolutely in love with it, so... Yeah, the BBC version really is really good. And I did enjoy the Ritchie one, but I really love Guy Ritchie's kind of sense of humor. So, yeah, and Jude Law as well. Well, that's a different story.
Did you want to say something about Emperor and Galilean?
Probably quite a lot. I don't know. Let me think. What happened?
Just don't. No spoilers.
Yes.
No spoilers.
It was incredible. But also, I've been talking to the guy that played the crazy old guy. the crazy old Scottish guy, I've been talking to him on Twitter, and he's been saying, you know, that they had no idea how it was going to go down with the audience, and you just never tell, and he seemed very impressed with how it's been received. And then he said, he was basically saying that last night was good, and tonight it had moved up a gear, and I just think, it moved up a gear from there? What's it going to be like by the actual opening night? It's going to be on fire by then.
Yeah.
It really is. It's going to be. And all the costumes as well, and the way they've sort of modernised it. I'm still a bit, oh my god, I'm in love. I need to see it again to have sensible thoughts about it.
Yeah, it's all about the coat, really.
we could talk for a very long time about how much we love this coat, although it was kind of split in two. Like, the first half, there's, like, this really fantastic, like, army coat, and then after the, like, we thought there's nothing that could be better than that, possibly.
And then Andrew comes on stage.
Oh, how we were wrong. I'm not going to say anything, just in case anyone's saying you're going to see it, but, oh my god, the coat. Yeah. If you like coats... Go and see this play.
Yeah, but no, the play is absolutely fantastic, and Andrew's absolutely amazing in it. Like, I've never been able to see him on stage, so it was really, like, a real pleasure. It was absolutely amazing. And
it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's like, even the people who don't have any lines, even they're all amazing. Like,
yeah,
everyone is so good.
The supporting cast is absolutely fantastic. Like, the entire company is really, really nicely put together.
Yeah, I think the way that it's not just scripted but choreographed, and like there's so much movement in the play, and the way that the set moves and the people move, and there's so, like, there's points in which there are so many people on stage, there's so much going on and so many different people. Like, it's a bit overwhelming.
It is
very overwhelming, but it's very good.
Yeah, I just want to take Agathon home.
Aww.
He's adorable and he's Scottish. What is there not to love?
And obviously, if you do go to the play, go to the stage door, because Andrew Scott is the most adorable human being in existence. And he is so sweet. If you get the chance to see Emperor and Galilean, you will enjoy it. Just be prepared to be, like, gobsmacked, I suppose.
Yeah.
To be very British about it.
Yes, you will be. You will be. Even if you're not British.
And there are some bits where you'll actually gasp. Well, I did, out loud. So,
yeah.
Like, the whole audience going...
I know there's lots of gasping and, like, squirming in your seat moments.
Well, one of them was ruined for me because I was close enough to see how it was done. And I'd noticed about 5 minutes before it happened. I was like, this is gonna be a gasp. I still gasped, but I was close enough to see how it was done. I was really disappointed. Don't sit in the front three rows on the left or you'll see how it's done.
If you've got a ticket for that now, sorry.
It's too late now. Obviously, like, you're absolutely fantastic. You're insanely talented. Like, thank you so much for doing the song. Like, your voice is absolutely fucking beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
Do you want to be, like, a singer? Like, what do you want to do with your life? Not that you want. You may already be doing something absolutely fantastic. I don't know.
Tumbling.
Tumblr is definitely a career choice of the future, I think.
Yes. I would like to do singing stuff. I'm actually trying to put together this band with two of my friends, and I warned them that if we do music, then they need to be aware that I write nerd songs and put them in public, and that there's going to be that stigma attached. And then they were just like, well, let's embrace it. What should we call the band? And so right now it's tentatively called Reichenbach Falls.
Oh!
They were really nice about it. But yeah, that's a thing that's happening. Actually, there's a really exciting thing happening, and I actually want to talk about it, and it's cool.
Ooh,
I'm so unprofessional. Well, I don't know if you guys saw it, but I did that song about Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I've been talking with Lynn from the Undershaw Preservation Trust, and we're actually trying to get a thing together to use that song to raise funds.
Brilliant.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's early stages, but it's very exciting, and it's really cool to be able to help out something that's that important and that I care that much about, and that I did not expect to even recognize that I wrote a song on YouTube. But, yeah, so that's an exciting thing that will happen with nerd music, just putting that out there.
And for some reason, Skype cut off our podcast, so you missed our goodbyes. But hearty thanks to Caitlin, Maria, Kaffers, and Turk. And keep listening, because there's a lot more to come. We have the news, and we have a special, special news section, as well as a new song at the end. Enjoy. And now, it's news time. Exciting news in the Arthur Conan Doyle world. His first novel that was lost in the post has been discovered and is going to be published later this autumn. It was written between 1883 and 84, when Arthur Conan Doyle was 23, and tells the story of a 50-year-old opinionated everyman named John Smith, who's confined to his room because of gout. It pretty much is about his conversations with his visitors. Because the original was lost in the post, or was it just rejected by the publisher? We don't know. It's what is being printed is what Arthur Conan Doyle wrote from memory, so it's only up until chapter 6. And it's pretty much, it's really interesting because it'll be, you'll be able to see his very early writing, because he's only 23 when he wrote it, and it's sort of like his journey from a short story writer to a novelist. It was written before studying Scarlet, so it is pre-Sherlock Holmes. But you can look for that later this autumn. If you want more information, you can go to the Guardian website, where they have done a full story on it. And now in Benedict Cumberbatch news, because there always is some, Benedict has been confirmed for The Hobbit. This is because Ian McKellen wrote a blog about it. He writes that he was shown a snippet of a screen test played in close-up into the camera. It was electrifying vocally and facially. It's pretty obvious that this is probably pointing more towards Smaug using screen capture. So this is very exciting. Also, Benedict has been confirmed for a new project called Parade's End. It is a 5-part series that will air on the BBC about World War I. Cumberbatch will play Christopher Titchens, not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, a top civil servant from the background of wealth and privilege whose marriage flounders almost as soon as it begins. His wife Sylvia, who will be played by Rebecca Hall, has an affair, while he also falls in love with another woman but remains honorable for some considerable time. How gentlemanlike. He's going to appear in virtually every single scene. The story will take place over a 10-year period. He was going to be in Anna Karenina, but he won't be able to do that anymore, and we believe that is because of this project. Lewis Briesley, who plays Molly Hooper, is currently performing in London at the Government Inspector at the Young Vic. There is news that a government inspector is due to arrive in a small Russian town, and it sends its bureaucrats into a panicked frenzy. A simple case of mistaken identity exposes the hypocrisy and corruption at the heart of the town and its biting moral satire. It's received great reviews, 4 and 5 stars. It's only playing until the 9th of July, so you should go and check it out. We got to go to the screening of The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and the Q&A with Mark Gatiss with special surprise guest Stephen Moffat. Maybe not that much of a surprise, though, because it was on Twitter, but...
Some people were maybe surprised. We weren't that surprised. It was good. It was the first time I've ever seen that film.
Me too.
It was absolutely fantastic. If any of you get a chance to see The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, or if you want to get the DVD, because apparently there's quite a lot of extra stuff on it, it's a really, really funny film.
Hysterical.
It is absolutely hysterical. I really loved the man who played Sherlock Holmes. I don't know who he is, actually. I'll have to find out.
Robert Stevens.
He wore a lot of makeup.
It's majorly a product of, you know, like the 70s and what they didn't realize about, you know, light.
It's definitely of its time. Like, I mean, it's dated, but it's still absolutely hilarious. The plot is really fast paced. And I cried at the end. Everybody else looked at me like I was crazy, but I got very emotionally involved in that film, and I did cry. So if any of you tend to do that, you will cry at the end of that film. And of course, the nice little treat that we got afterwards is that there was a Q&A, which was meant to be obviously just with Mark Gatiss, but we got the dynamic duo instead. And they talked about when they first watched or heard about Sherlock Holmes in their childhoods. It was actually quite fascinating because both of them, I think, actually saw film versions.
Yeah, they saw a film version first. They didn't read them first.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting because that's very parallel to, like, I think quite a lot of people's experiences now, because we're obviously seeing the film version and the BBC version. And what was really nice is they're really encouraging to people to go out and not just to read the stories, but to watch all of the different film adaptations, the TV series and things. So it's almost like, you know, if you watch Sherlock and you're involved in these things, you're sort of involved in something that's even bigger than just that, because they're not like, just watch our show, don't do anything else. They're like, no, go and do these other things as well.
They're proper fanboys, and that's what was so great. And you actually got to see them, like, fanboying over it, like,
they really,
really,
were.
Really excited.
They really were. that's what's really nice about it as well, because they are very enthusiastic fans, and they obviously do it out of love more than anything else. It's like a product of, like, love.
It's quite touching.
It's very touching. I think it's very touching. So yes, that was it. It was a good night overall. And yes, some of the Baker Street Babes got to have their photographs taken with Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat. They're very happy about that.
they were very sweet, very sweet, very tired.
Yes, they were very tired.
And Maria, who was on the podcast with us, she recorded the entire thing, so we're going to upload that for all of you. As far as we know, it is the only actual recording, so you got it from us.
Oh, yeah.
Well, not really us, but Maria.
Yeah. Someone who is affiliated with us.
Yes, affiliated. No, it was really good, and you should definitely go see the film. It takes a whole different look at everything, and the friendship in that film, I think, is really very touching.
Yeah.
It's also the funniest I've ever seen.
Yeah, it is funny. I think when you're watching it, you can definitely see a lot of influences for the Sherlock BBC TV series. Like, they lifted loads of stuff. Like, Mycroft is pretty much directly lifted from this film, which is, he's hilarious in it as well, in a really sinister kind of way. watching Mark Gatiss do his Mr. Burns impression was quite funny. But definitely go and see it. And overall, it was a lovely experience.
All right, we want to do a few shout-outs. Since our first podcast, we've had over 700 downloads and streams, and that is very large in part to our Twitter friends and Tumblr friends and everyone who's been sort of spreading our name around.
So we wanted to say a special thank you to Sherlockology.
Yes. The Food Patch Problem at the Sherlock Fan site.
And the Diogenes Club, which has taken us about a week to learn how to say. So I hope you guys appreciate that. We certainly appreciate all the retweets and reblogs that you've been giving us. And thank you very much for listening, everybody. We've decided to add a new feature to the show, which is Kaffa's Story Corner. So from now on, I will be reading one of the Sherlock Holmes stories every week, a little sort of 5-minute blip of it. So I hope you enjoy. Beryl Coronet. "Holmes," said I, as I stood one morning in our bow window looking down the street, "here is a madman coming along. It seems rather sad that his relatives should allow him to come out alone." My friend rose lazily from his armchair and stood with his hands in the pockets of his dressing gown, looking over my shoulder. It was a bright, crisp February morning, and the snow of the day before still lay deep upon the ground, shimmering brightly in the wintry sun. Down the centre of Baker Street it had been ploughed into a brown, crumbly brand by the traffic, but at either side, on the heaped-up edges of the footpaths, it lay as white as when it had fell. The grey pavement had been cleaned and scraped, but was still dangerously slippery, so that there were fewer passengers than usual. Indeed, from the direction of the Metropolitan Station, no one was coming save the single gentleman whose eccentric conduct had drawn my attention. He was a man of about 50, tall, portly, and imposing, with a massive, strongly marked face and a commanding figure. He was dressed in a sombre yet rich style, in black frock coat, shining hat, neat brown gaiters, and well-cut pearl-grey trousers. Yet his actions were in absurd contrast to the dignity of his dress and features, for he was running hard, with occasional little springs, such as a weary man gives who is still accustomed to set any tax upon his legs. As he ran, he jerked his hands up and down, waggled his head, and wreathed his face into the most extraordinary contortions. "What on earth can be the matter with him?" I asked. "He is looking up at the numbers of the houses." "I believe he is coming here," said Holmes, rubbing his hands. "Here?" Yes, I rather think he is coming to consult me professionally. I think that I recognize the symptoms. Ha! Did I not tell you? As he spoke, the man, puffing and blowing, rushed at our door and pulled out our bell until the whole house resounded with the clanging. A few moments later, he was in our room, still puffing, still gesticulating, but with so fixed a look of grief and despair in his eyes that our smiles were turned into an instant to horror and pity. For a while he could not get his words out, but swayed his body and plucked at his hair like one who had been driven to the extreme limits of his reason. Then, suddenly springing to his feet, he beat his head against the wall with such force that we both rushed upon him and tore him away to the centre of the room. Sherlock Holmes pushed him down into the easy chair and, sitting beside him, patted his hand and chatted with him in the easy, soothing tones which he knew so well how to employ. "You have come to tell me your story, have you not?" he said. "You are fatigued with your haste. Pray wait until you have recovered yourself, and then I shall be most happy to look into any little problem which you may submit to me." The man sat for a minute or more with a heaving chest, fighting against his emotion. Then he passed his handkerchief over his brow, set his lips tight, and turned his face towards us. "No doubt you think me mad," he said. "I see that you have some great trouble," responded Holmes. "God knows I have. A trouble which is enough to upset my reason, so sudden and so terrible it is. Public disgrace I might have faced, although I am a man whose character has not yet borne a stain. Private affliction also is the lot of every man, but the two coming together, and in so frightful a form, have been enough to shake my very soul. Besides, it is not I alone. The very nobles in the land may suffer unless some way is found out of this horrible affair." "Pray compose yourself, sir," said Holmes, "and let me have a clear account of who you are and what it is that has befallen you." "My name," said our visitor, "is probably familiar to your ears. I am Alexander Holder, of the banking firm of Holder and Stevenson, of Threadneedle Street." The man was indeed well known to us, as belonging to the senior partner in the second largest private banking concern in the City of London. What could have happened, then, to bring one of the foremost citizens of London to this most pitiable pass? We waited, all curiosity, until with another effort he braced himself to tell us his story. And that's all for this time, so remember to download the next episode and you'll be able to hear some more of our lovely story.
If this whole day and world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine? Molly, my love, your heart's like a light, your smile's like a lamp on your gloves. Your touch and your work grab the heart of a man when I feel your body back under your hand. So pull me up on your autopsy table, 'cause you've seen enough, you deserve someone stable. I will earn your love to the best I am able. Take your lipstick off and let your head down. Your crush was corrosive, I fear. I never will treat you so badly as that. Your science is starting like you, that's a fact. So pull me up on your autopsy table, 'cause you've seen enough, you deserve someone stable. Your head down, talk.